So that leads to a chapter that's called Mendel and the Gene Idea, which is mostly about Mendelian genetics, named in his honor. His honor meaning referring to Gregor Mendel. Now, is this a household name? He's still not famous. You have heard of him? Well, he's much famous. He's much more famous now that he's dead, unfortunately. He never really got the credit for it while he was alive. But he's now known as the father of genetics. And that's because in the mid-1800s, before anyone had any idea what DNA was or what a gene is, he figured out a lot of the basics of how genetics works. Not ever looking at any molecules, just by being a very careful scientist working with pea plants for many years. And by the way, this one is Gregor Mendel. He was a monk, and that probably helped him. He probably had more time on his hands than a lot of other people to be so careful. But he was unusual for a biologist of his time, because back then, biologists were mostly observational scientists. You know, they go out into nature, observe things, and report how things happen. It wasn't so much of an experimental science. And there wasn't nearly as much appreciation back then for the power of statistics and the importance of replicates, meaning doing the same thing in an experiment over and over using many subjects rather than just one or two. Mendel did each of his experiments hundreds or thousands of times. And it's a good thing he did, because he wouldn't have been able to figure out everything he did figure out if he didn't have such high replicates. Well, none of that was appreciated by the mainstream biologists at the time. And so even though he did publish a groundbreaking paper, it didn't become groundbreaking until someone discovered it after he died later. But the stuff that he figured out is still the truth many years later. Let's take a look at how he performed his experiments. He did 7 major experiments using pea plants. They were all using the same species, but each experiment had to be in its own field, kept separate from the rest. They weren't the same individual plants used in the different experiments, but they were all pea plants. And pea plants are examples of not only angiosperms, or flowering plants, flower-producing plants, but the flowers that they produce are examples of what we call complete flowers. Not all flowers are like this, but in pea plants they are. Complete means that they have all of the parts of a flower, including both sexual parts. There's the male parts and the female parts, both in a complete flower. The male parts, by the way, are called stamens. They're the real slender ones in this picture. They're what produce pollen grains. Pollen grains contain sperm, so they produce the male gametes. The female part, the carpel here, includes a sticky little end called the stigma that pollen grains can stick to. Well, that sticking of the pollen grains to the carpel is not fertilization, but it allows for the sperm in the pollen to bore through this whole length of the carpel and get to the base, which is where the ovary is that produces the egg, and that's where fertilization can take place. That's how it happens naturally, but it's a fairly random event as with respect to which parents get their gametes together. Of course, now, this is a sexual species that doesn't mate, right? Plants are planted in the ground. They don't get up and find each other. But their gametes have to come into contact with each other for it to be fertilization. And that's what I'm saying is fairly random. Either the wind randomly blows pollen grains, or pollinating insects or bats come and just accidentally brush the pollen. Well, that's a variable that Mendel wanted to eliminate. He didn't want the randomness. He wanted to be in control of which parent reproduces with which other parent. And so he had to carefully remove the stamens with scissors carefully noting which of his thousands of plants he was doing this with each time, and collecting carefully with a brush the pollen from those, and then transporting it to a specific plant somewhere else that he could brush it onto the female part of that flower. In other words, choosing that recipient flower as the mother and the one that he got the pollen from as the father, and making careful notes about it for many years. That, in practice, other than doing it thousands of times, that's pretty straightforward practice, but that's just the beginning of it. Then you wait until the fruit is produced, which in this case is the pod of peas. Each seed, each pea, individual pea, is an individual. These are siblings to each other, genetically different from each other, just like brothers and sisters are, right? This is just the litter that it produced. So the next step then, he can't tell anything about these pea plants by looking at the peas, right? So he has to plant them and then wait until the next year when they grow up into adults, and then he can finally look at their characteristics to get the results. So it takes many years, much patience, and a lot of note-taking. But he did it well. Anyway, this first generation is called the P generation, P for parental. Once you grow up these peas into individual offspring, then you can then cross those. Well, they make up what's called the F1 generation, first filial generation. Filial means of offspring. Well, they're going to produce their own pollen and eggs, so he can do the same technique with them, crossing F1 with another F1. In other words, like mating brothers and sisters. And then do the same process, wait till the next year until the F2 generation grows up, and then he can look at those results. That's the basic technique. But he did it for 7 different experiments in each of which he paid attention to just one characteristic. And what made the 7 experiments different from each other is that the thing that he paid attention to, the characteristic, was different in each of them. So this brings up something that's important to say before we go on. And that's the difference between characteristic and trait. Those two words in everyday language are used pretty much interchangeably. And that's fine for colloquial talk when you're not really talking about genetics. But in genetics, they are not the same thing. A characteristic is something about an organism, as you would expect from the knowledge of the word already. But it's a little bit like a category. Whereas a trait is an individual example within that category. Now, you'll get a much better idea of what I just meant by all of that with an example. Here we have one characteristic. This is the results of one of his experiments. And in this experiment, the only characteristic he cared about is flower color. You see how flower color as a characteristic is kind of like a category, right? There's multiple possibilities. Well, those multiple individual possibilities, or the values for that characteristic, are called traits. Purple is one trait of flower color, the characteristic. White is another trait of the same characteristic. So you get a good feel of the difference between those two? Okay. Now, most of the credit goes to Mendel being very careful. But he also got a little bit lucky, I think, in that for all 7 of his experiments, he chose a characteristic, and I don't know whether this was intentional or not, to tell you the truth. He might not be luck. But in all of his 7 experiments, the characteristic that he chose, there was only 2 possible traits for, which is not always the case, right? If you think about human hair color or eye color, There isn't just two possibilities in our population, right? There can be more than two. But he chose characteristic one at a time for each experiment that had exactly two traits in the population. So purple flower and white flower were the only possibilities for flower color. And by the way, it doesn't have to be something that you see. We're just visual animals, so we tend to use examples that are visible or visual based. But a characteristic could be something like how well an enzyme works, right? There could be multiple traits of that. Very fast, fast, slow, right? Okay, well anyway, in each of his cases, there were two traits for each of his chosen characteristic. And each experiment paid attention to only one characteristic. So this was a whole plot of land dedicated to this experiment. There was all other kinds of characteristics for each of those plants, right? He just didn't care about anything other than the flower color for that set. Well, before he could even do this work of setting up this one experiment, he had to do preliminary work, which probably took years to do even before he could get to the beginning of this. And that's because he made sure that he was using true breeding purple-flowered individuals and true breeding white-flowered individuals. True breeding means that genetically, and he didn't know anything about genes, but the modern interpretation is that they have only purpleness to pass on to offspring. And white-flowered, true breeding white-flowered one has only whiteness to pass on. That doesn't have to be the case. The way that he did it to ensure that is to keep breeding purple with purple to make sure that there were never any white flowers that came out. Then he said, okay, these must be true breeding purple flowers, and the same with the white. That was before he could even start. Then we get to the start of this experiment, in which case his two parents of making up the parental generation were a purple, true breeding purple flowered individual, a true breeding white flowered individual. Okay, that was his cross. That's why you have an X between those. And he did that hundreds of times, not just once. But what he noticed once he got the peas from those offspring, planted them, and then looked at the grown-up individuals of the F1 generation the next year, is that every one of the F1 offspring were purple-flowered individuals. None of them was white-flowered. Now this by itself is kind of surprising when you think about it, because Mendel was in the mid-1800s, but for thousands of years before that, we had already known that sexual species pass traits down to their offspring, and offspring aren't really like either parent completely, right? They're kind of like a mixture of the two. So it would be a reasonable prediction, just knowing that from everyday life, that when you do this cross, you would expect the F1s to be purplish white. Not fully purple, not fully white. But that's not what happened. Not only were they all purple in the F1, but they were all completely purple, just as purple as the true breeding purple flowered individual parent. And none of them was white. Well, that's interesting by itself, but Mendel had the foresight to think, what would happen if I then crossed those with each other? So that's when he took F1 and another F1, brothers and sisters, and made the F2 generation by planting the peas that they came up with and waiting for the next year. The F2 generation then featured some white-flowered individuals again. And here's where his high number of replicates paid off. If you did this only once or twice, you might have no white flowers, you might have no purple flowers, in which case you would conclude, well, the second generation is always purple or is always white, right? That would be wrong. But since he did it 1,000 times here, these are his real numbers, he noticed that it was pretty damn close to one quarter of the F2s were the white version and three quarters were purple version. So this brings up two kinds of traits. Notice that the white trait, which was there originally, kind of seems like it's hiding for a generation. And another name for hide is recede. Recede into the to a crevice, right? That's why that trait is called the recessive trait. It's just the adjective of recede. And the other trait, which is purple in this case, is the dominant trait. So what he showed is that in this kind of cross, the recessive trait disappears in the F1 generation and then reappears in the F2 generation as one quarter of the F2, whereas there's three quarters of the F2 made up of dominant individuals. Now, speaking of this cross, this is an example of a monohybrid cross. Mono means one, of course, and the one here refers to the fact that in this cross, he chose to pay attention to only one characteristic, flower color. The hybrid part refers to the fact that in this original parental generation, the two parents differed from each other in their traits for this one characteristic that's being studied. One of them was purple and one of them was white. If he'd done a purple cross with another purple, it wouldn't be a hybrid cross, is what I'm saying. It's a hybrid cross because the parents are different in their traits, and it's a monohybrid cross because only one characteristic is being tracked. So that leads to an F2 generation featuring a 3-to-1 ratio of dominant to recessive individuals. Well, slide 4 shows you the other 6 of his 7 experiments. Shows you all 7 of the experiments. This top row is the one that we just looked at. In a different plot of land, he was tracking a totally different characteristic. Flower position. Doesn't matter what color it is, it's where it is on the plant. And then seed color and seed shape and so on for all 7. He did the same technique for all of them. He just paid attention to a different characteristic in each plot of land. And you see his real numbers here. He did some of them a hell of a lot of times. But what he noticed is that in each case, for each individual characteristic, one of the two possible traits, because remember I already told you that there were only 2 possible for each of these, one of those 2 possible traits was dominant over the other, and there were no recessives in any of the F1s for any of these experiments. So in each case, the F1 was made up of 100% dominant type. And for each of the F2s, there was a 3-to-1 ratio of dominant type to recessive type. So it wasn't just for flower color. That's for any Mendelian gene or Mendelian characteristic. Okay, Mendelian just means that it's operating in a way that we name after Mendel. That's not how things have to be, though. And we'll look at exceptions to Mendelian genetics later in the chapter. But for a characteristic to behave in a Mendelian fashion, 2 things have to be true. I've mentioned these, but I'll list them again. One is that there have to be exactly 2 traits for the characteristic, not more. And one of those 2 traits has to completely dominate over the other, which isn't always true. OK, Okay? If those weren't true, he would have had a hell of a harder time figuring out his numbers, because it becomes a lot more confusing when there are exceptions to those assumptions. But that's what Mendelian genetics is. And let me further explain what... I'll explain that one with a different picture. So hold that thought. Let's look at 5 now. This is a pea plant's... a couple of chromosomes from a pea plant. Now, I don't know what the N of pea plants is, but it's more than one. All right, I don't know whether it's more than humans or fewer than humans, but it's not just one. This is just one type of chromosome that we're looking at here, right? And there's two of them because pea plants, just like us, are diploid individuals. So there's two number whatever this is. The rest of the chromosomes we just don't care about, because in a single experiment you track a single characteristic. Well, I talked about characteristics and alleles. You're still comfortable with the difference of those, right? Between those terms? I mean characteristics and traits. Okay. A characteristic corresponds molecularly to a gene. The gene is the molecular thing that controls a characteristic. And you already know what a gene is. It's just a subsequence of DNA nucleotides, right? Within the overall longer sequence that we call the chromosome. But a characteristic corresponds to a gene. A trait, on the other hand, corresponds to what we call an allele. An allele is a version of a gene. Or it's better to say it this way. Alleles are different versions of the same gene. What we care about in this experiment is flower color. That's the characteristic. That is controlled by a gene that determines the flower color indirectly, and we therefore call it the flower color gene. The flower color gene, like any other individual gene, occupies a certain position in the overall sequence. So a certain position on the chromosome. And that particular position for an individual gene is called its locus. Same root as in location. There are hundreds to thousands of other genes on this same chromosome. We just don't care about them because that's not the experiment, right? All we care about is the flower color gene, and it occupies a specific locus. This is a diploid individual, though, so there are two of this chromosome that has the flower color gene. And therefore, an individual pea plant has two flower color alleles. One on one chromosome, one on the other chromosome. There's three ways this can happen, though. There's three possibilities, I should say. One possibility for a diploid individual is that both of the alleles, one on each of the two homologous chromosomes, have the same, both of those alleles are the same as each other. But there's two ways that can happen, right? Two ways for them to be the same. They could both be, in this case, the purple version, which is the dominant version, or they could both be the white version, which is the recessive version. That's two of three possibilities. The only other possibility, if you have two alleles, is to have both versions, one of each. One on one chromosome, one on the other chromosome. Right, a purple and a white. So those three possibilities have different phrases that we use to denote them. Just by itself, the word homozygous refers to the condition in which the two alleles in the individual are the same version. But I told you there's two ways that can happen, right? So homozygous is never used by itself. That doesn't tell you what the alleles are. It just tells you they're the same as each other. But it doesn't tell you whether they're both purple or they're both white. So that's why you have to modify homozygous with either the word dominant or recessive. A homozygous dominant individual has both of its alleles are the dominant version. You could have a homozygous recessive individual. Both of them are the recessive version. That would be both whites in this case. This one, though, is neither of those, right? Because one allele is the purple version and the other allele is the white version. In that case, one word is enough, because there's only one way for that to happen. One of each, and we just use the word heterozygous for that. Homo means same, hetero means different. Notice that zygous refers to the zygote that is possible for this parent to create, with the help of another parent, of course, right? Remember that fertilization creates a zygote. Well, if all we care about is flower color, which we are at the moment, then just ignore all the other genes. This individual has two possible kinds of gametes that it's able to make with respect to flower color. Meiosis is going to randomly choose one or the other chromosome, like we've been talking about. So it's going to choose this allele or this allele, not both, because it's going to make a haploid gamete. So a heterozygous individual can make two different types of zygotes depending on which gamete it fertilizes the other gamete with. Right? But a homozygous can make only one kind, either a purple one or a white one, depending on whether it's homozygous dominant or homozygous recessive. Now, does all of that make sense?
I think I got one.
Do you know where?
The part when the homozygous dominant, I get those, like how they're one of each, but then how you're talking about, like, it's going to pick like one or the other allele?
Well, think back to the previous chapter. Meiosis...
Meiosis is pick one.
Well, what I mean by pick is that when the original cell splits into two in meiosis one, one of these chromosomes is going to go into one cell and the other one's going to go into the other cell.
So
the gametes that result are going to be either this type or this type.
That would be like after all the crossing over and everything?
Yeah.
Why?
Right. But if this were a homozygous dominant and they're both purple, it doesn't matter because both of those cells will be the purple version, both of the gametes, or gametes to be. Right?
Yes.
So a homozygous individual can only make one kind of gamete with respect to that particular characteristic. A heterozygous individual can make two different kinds of gametes because it has two different alleles to pass on, one or the other.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is this heterozygous?
Yes, this is heterozygous, because there's a dominant allele in the locus on one chromosome and a recessive allele at the same locus in the other homolog. Well, armed with that information, let's look at this first Mendelian experiment with a little bit more detail added. So we have pictures of the parents. We had that before. That's new information. But notice that there is a line here for appearance and for genetic makeup. There are better phrases for that than what the book used. This brings up two more definitions: phenotype and genotype. The phenotype of an individual is a description of the trait. So it's a word or a phrase that describes the actual trait that individual has. Like purple-flowered That's a phenotype. White flowered is a phenotype. Genotype, on the other hand, is a symbolic representation of the alleles that that individual has for the gene in question. So we don't use words or phrases, we use symbols, usually letters. Notice these genetic makeup things, which are really should have been called genotypes, are strings of letters. All right, now there, unfortunately, there's more than one standard that's used, which is makes things more difficult, but this is the first of some standards that I'll teach you. For genotypes, in this simple Mendelian case, what we do is use a letter that is the initial for the dominant trait. In this case, the characteristic is flower color. The dominant trait is purple, so that's where P comes from. Purpleness. But somewhat confusingly at first, P is used to denote both purple flowers and white flowers. The P is there in both cases just to remind you that regardless of what this flower color is, the dominant trait is purple. Instead of using different letters, we use P to remind us always that which one is dominant. And then we use an uppercase letter to actually denote the dominant phenotype. But each individual P is an allele, represents an allele. Okay? So there are two possible alleles in this population. Purple and white, like we just looked at in that previous slide of the two chromosomes. Right? Why? Oh, well, let me just continue this uppercase. The lowercase p denotes the white allele. It's still p, just to remind you that purple is dominant over white. But lowercase means recessive. Why is the genotype for each parent two p's, two letter p's? Each individual P is an allele. So why are there two for each parent? Not a chromosome. A homologous pair of chromosomes has two. In other words, there's two P's because each parent is diploid. Each parent has two alleles, right, for flower color. Because it has two of the chromosome that carries the flower color gene. That's the two chromosomes I just showed you in the previous slide. It's a diploid organism, so it has two of each type of chromosome, including the type of chromosome that carries this gene that we care about, which is flower color, and therefore it has two alleles, one on each of the two chromosomes. Right? This one is a true breeding purple flowered individual because it is homozygous dominant. Uppercase P corresponds to homozygous dominant. The fact that they're both the same case is homozygous. The fact that they're both uppercase means it's homozygous dominant. This is a homozygous recessive individual. Lowercase p. Right? Okay, those are the original parents. They're diploid. But in order for them to be parents, to produce offspring, they need to first make gametes individually through meiosis, which is going to choose randomly one of those two alleles. Well, it's going to choose one of the chromosomes, but the chromosome's carrying the allele, right? Well, in a true breeding or homozygous individual, it doesn't matter which one you choose. So this true breeding purple flowered individual is only able to make one kind of, we'll call it sperm for the purple one, uppercase P. Doesn't matter which one you choose. And this one can make only one kind of egg, lowercase p, right? That's why they're called homozygous. They're only going to be able to pass on one kind, which one of the traits. Since there's only one possible gamete from each parent, when you get them together in fertilization to produce the F1, there's only one possible genotype that's diploid for those diploid individuals. Notice these genotypes for the gametes are haploid genotypes, just one P, because they're gametes. They have only one chromosome, one allele. But when they get together to form a zygote for each individual is now diploid, and it is a combination of both of these gamete genotypes, right? It's a diploid genotype. And the only possibility, when you have to have an uppercase P gamete of one sex and a lowercase p of the other sex, is for it to be uppercase P, lowercase p. In other words, heterozygous. So this explains what Mendel saw, explains why 100% of the F1 generation were purple flowered. Because they were all heterozygous individuals, and because purple is dominant over white, what that means specifically is that it takes only one dominant allele to make the individual have the dominant phenotype. That's what complete dominance is. I didn't mention that before because I hadn't told you about alleles at the time yet. But what dominance means is that it takes only one dominant allele for an individual to have the dominant phenotype. Yes, an individual can have two dominant alleles, but that doesn't make that individual even more dominant in its phenotype. That's why the F1 generations, which are all heterozygous, just one dominant allele in each of them, were just as purple as the flowers of the original homozygous individual. Okay, that's complete dominance of purple over white in this case. So it explains why there's no whites, because if there's complete dominance, then the only way that you can have the recessive trait, the recessive phenotype, is to be homozygous recessive, right? Because if you have only one dominant, you're going to have the dominant phenotype. The only way you can avoid that is to have both of your alleles be the recessive type, which is homozygous recessive. Well, there aren't any of those when every one of them is heterozygous. So there were no white individuals in the F1. Now you cross upper lower P with another upper lower P to produce the F2 generation. And that brings up this device we have down on the bottom here, which is called Punnett Square, named after a dead Englishman. And a Punnett Square is just a shorthand device, really. But it represents a real biological event or process. The process that a Punnett Square represents is the defining process of sex. What is the process that defines sex? Exactly. A species is sexual if and only if fertilization occurs in that species. That's what defines sex. And what is fertilization? No, that's...
Sex chromosomes?
Zygotes is an important word. That's not the entire definition. Fertilization is the fusion of two unicellular gametes to produce a unicellular zygote.
Yeah.
That's why it doubles the ploidy, right? Because the ploidy of the zygote is going to be double the ploidy of each gamete, since the two genomes are combined into one genome. That's the whole problem that you have to have meiosis for, right? To reduce it in half again, so that it doesn't double every generation. Okay, so a Punnett square is really just an exhaustive representation of every gamete that a given set of two parents can produce. And those gametes are listed to the top of and to one side of the Punnett square. So you have sperm on the top here, eggs on the side. But notice that for this particular cross, for the F2 generation, which could be represented by just writing the genotypes of the parents in the cross, so upper lower P by upper lower P, that's how you would write that cross. A heterozygous individual from the F1 crossed with a heterozygous individual also from F1. Brother and sister, in other words, from F1. Do you see that? Well, these are not true breeding individuals. They're heterozygotes, which is the word that means a heterozygous individual. All right? And therefore, when it comes time for each of these heterozygous parents individually to make their own gametes, randomly picking one or the other makes a difference, right? If this is the male, a sperm could be an uppercase P or a lowercase P. That's why both are listed here. That's an exhaustive list of every possible sperm he could make if all you care about is flower color. I mean, yes, in this case, flower color. Similarly, she can pick, by her meiosis, either an uppercase P or a lowercase P, two kinds of eggs. No other possibilities if all you care about is flower color. Is that all clear? Well, the boxes within the Punnett square represent what? If the whole Punnett square represents the process of fertilization, what do the boxes represent? Eventually, but what immediately? What does fertilization produce?
Zygotes.
That's what each box represents in a Punnett square. The possible zygotes that these parents can produce with respect to the one characteristic that you care about. So the fact that there's four boxes in this Punnett square does not in any way mean that these parents are going to have four offspring. They might have one, they might have a million. Depends on the species, right? What it says, though, is that these particular two parents can produce only these four kinds of zygotes. Each one is simply choosing one of the two possible eggs and matching it up with two of the possible sperm. You match up row and column, and notice that each zygote has a diploid genotype, whereas each gamete has a haploid genotype. So that's where the upper P came from, matching this P and this P in the gametes. Since these are the only gametes these parents can make, these are the only types of zygotes they can make with respect to flower color. And this doesn't mean that they're going to have four offspring. It means that however many they have, you would expect or predict one quarter of them to be recessive, white-colored, and three quarters of them to be dominant or purple. And that's because for dominance, all you need is one uppercase P. That happens in all three of these. To be white, you can't have any uppercase P. That can only happen in one quarter of the possibilities. So that's where the 3-to-1 ratio comes from that Mendel got in all seven of his experiments, because there was complete dominance of one allele over the other. Okay. Well, this then... Am I over?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't you stop me?
That's
not only a palindrome, but a homogeneous radially symmetrical palindrome.